It's the essence of corporate governance is frankly one of the things that makes American capital markets so powerful and robust that shareholders have the ability to change the outcome of the stocks they invest in.
Welcome into Studying Success. On this podcast, I interview investors and entrepreneurs who tell us about their life, the ins and outs of their industries, and the different ways that they have found success. Hi, John. It's so great to see you.
Hey, well, it's great to see you again, buddy. How's life in Spain? How's the citizen of the planet doing over there?
Pretty good. My Spanish is getting a lot better. I'm progressing there, going to a lot of Spanish cafes and eating some very yummy chocolate croissants. So life is good. How's New York?
It's good, but I was always a big fan of tapas in Spain. I thought it was the most brilliant idea in the world. I think I'm going to have to come visit you and we can go for some jamon and some cheese. New York's good. You know, spring is trying to get started. There's some buds outside my window here. Been a little rainy, a little gray, but it's coming around. It's warming up. I'm supposed to play golf this weekend, which I'm excited about.
Nice.
My first time out, which will be a mess, of course, but we're just getting there. The kids are already starting to make summer plans, so you know it's coming.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself? Give us a little introduction.
For sure. I'm happy to do it. Hopefully it won't be too boring. I don't know that there's anything particularly unique about my story. I grew up on Long Island, a little town called Manhasset, and I guess if there's anything to note that might be relevant to your listeners. I was a public school kid. I went to all my schools, elementary school, junior high, high school, was always Manhasset Public High. And then even when I went off to college, I was still a public school student. I went to the University of Massachusetts. So, you know, I'd say relatively humble beginnings. I had the odd summer jobs like everybody else. I had a paper route. I had some fun summer jobs. I worked in a lobster and seafood company. I used to deliver lobsters all over the city, played sports. I wrestled, I played lacrosse, a couple years on the football team until I got injured. But, you know, I was an okay student. I wasn't a straight A student. I wasn't top of my class, but I worked hard and I think I had a good balance between, you know, social life and sports and school and family and work. You know, like I said, I definitely had a bunch of jobs, including working in my dad's factory for a couple summers, which was really fun. But yeah, I probably pretty unremarkable, no sparks of greatness there. Nobody would have seen the early state of me and thought that I might be doing anything worthwhile once I got out of school.
And would you say you were interested in investing from a young age, or did that interest come about later?
And I was interviewing for my first job. And one of the things I did do a lot as a kid, my father took me to the racetrack, believe it or not, horse races. And at a very young age, he taught me how to handicap horses. And so, as I mentioned, I went to UMass, a public school, and we weren't particularly well trained. You know, a lot of kids that go to Harvard and Yale and more, they get trained very specifically of what life is like in investment banking, and they get trained to go to the investment banks. But, you know, UMass was a fine school and I learned a lot, but I wasn't particularly trained in the rigors of what it was going to be like to be a junior investment banker. And so I'd had about a dozen interviews with a dozen firms at that point and didn't get one job offer. And I was going to what I considered to be my last possible interview. And if I didn't get this job, I was going to go to Colorado. I was going to be a ski bum. I was going to be a lift attendant. I was ready to just throw in the towel. No, I'm not kidding. I was like, this has got to be my last shot. And the interview progressed as they normally do. And they say, you know, talk to us about, you know, what you know about relative valuation, and talk to us what you know about comparable analysis, and what classes at school did you take to learn comparable analysis, relative valuation. And I said, you know, something, you know, I went to UMass and I didn't go to Harvard and Wharton and Yale. And I'll be honest with you, we studied those classes, but the place I learned the most about comparable analysis and valuation was at the racetrack betting on horses. And I proceed to go through the story of, you know, comparable analysis. You'd look at this horse versus that horse and this race versus that race and this distance and that track. And then the valuations were what the odds were. If it's even money, it's a really high valued stock. If it's 100-1, it's a dog. It's a low valuation stock. And only time I ever told that story, and it was the only job offer I ever got.
Where did you go from there? You got that job, and then how did you get to where you are now in terms of your career?
God only knows. At every role I had at the early stage of my career, it never was so much for me what I was doing at that one specific moment. When you're a junior investment banker, you work countless hours and you do a lot of financial modeling and put presentations together. And frankly, you spend a lot of time on jamming the photocopy machine. And we used to call ourselves photocopy engineers, you know, and it was never so much what I was doing at that moment. I looked as many rungs up the ladder as I could. And I said to myself, do I like that job? Do I like the job my boss's boss is doing? And if I did, it kept me motivated. And I said, you know what? I get it. This is an entry level job. Some of this stuff isn't fun. And I mean, I pulled all nighters. We'd work all night through the morning and to the next day. And there was some camaraderie to it. It was like boot camp, I guess. But you kept looking at your bosses and you're like, wow, that's a great job. I really see myself doing that. So it kind of kept me hanging on in the early stages. And then I would say, I didn't go to business school, you know, so I went to undergrad and then I got my first job at Salomon Brothers. And one of the things I think I did, I was very curious. And you find that so many people are really happy to share what they know. And I probably got an MBA's worth of knowledge just from asking people, what do you do? You know, and I'd talk to people in different parts of the firm and I'd say, oh, what do you do? What's liability management? And what are share repurchases? And how do bonds trade? And I wouldn't just go and they'd say, go get these numbers. And I'd get the numbers and come back. I'd always try to inquire about what they were doing. And so it was great for two reasons. One, obviously I learned a lot, but two, and you'll find in your career, you network, you meet so many more people. And they say like, oh, that curious young man, he's got a bright mind, he's interested, right? You know, how do people know, you know, whether you're interested or not? You got to ask questions. So I asked a lot of questions and I learned a lot and that kept my eyes wide open. So I was able to see different avenues and I pivoted a bunch of times in my career. I went from banking to sales and trading to research. That's all what we call the sell side. And then I went to the buy side and I was in hedge funds. I did private equity and now I do activism. So I was always open to what else might be out there and kept a wide perspective. And then I think asked a lot of questions to make sure if there are other opportunities I might be interested in what they might look like.
Could you talk about those different jobs you had and what the day-to-day of those jobs consisted of?
My first job, as I said, it was an analyst in an investment bank. It's a pretty standard program most banks have, and they're these two-year programs. You come out of undergrad, and they basically work you to the bone. And my experience was maybe a little bit different than others. I had a great team that I worked for, and I worked really hard, but I also got a lot of exposure. So as I look back, what was wild about that is, on one hand, I would be building a model for a merger, you know, trying to combine two companies together. How do we put the financials together? And I could work all night and I could work on it for a week in the most menial of kind of banking tasks, right? You're just grinding numbers in a model. You're not really interacting with anybody. But then at the end of the week, I could fly off to, you know, I remember one meeting in Seattle. We finished the deck. We got on a plane. We flew to Seattle. The next thing I know, I'm in this boardroom with all these incredibly senior people and CEOs and directors. I mean, I was 21 years old and I'm presenting to these people. So it was like the range of things that you would do was really pretty remarkable. Oh, one fun part I should throw out there. I did 2 years in investment banking and then was asked to stay for a third year. You know, most kids do 2 years investment banking. They go back to business school and they come back. I was asked to stay for a third year and I was sent to Australia. I got to work in Salomon Brothers Sydney, Australia office, which was really fun. And then from there, they asked me to stay on to be an associate, right? Which is the next level. Maybe that's another point of differentiation. You know, a lot of people go back to business school. I felt like I was learning so much on the ground and I didn't want to stop the trajectory I was on. You know, sometimes a lot of entry-level jobs, you get stuck in a dead end and you realize like, this is not where I want to be. And it's great. You go back to business school, you reset, and you come back out 2 years later with your MBA and you probably have more opportunities. I think I was really lucky in my first job. Gave me a lot of avenues and a lot of potential. And so I was able to just keep pursuing those types of things without having gone back to business school.
Can we talk about what you're doing now?
So activist investing, right? So, you know, I talked about the sell side, you know, where these big investment banks have the investment banking division, this research division, the sales and trading division. Then there's the buy side, right? The ones that are actually managing other people's money, managing their own money, buying securities and hoping to make money because they buy something and it goes higher. Pretty simple, right? At the end of the day, that's all we're doing. We're trying to identify something and pay $20 for it and hopefully sell it for $40 in a year or two. Couldn't be more basic. That's what we do. Mm-hmm. Activism, as the name suggests, we're active investors. So 75%, 80% of the world are passive investors. They buy a stock in the public markets. They hope the management's doing a good job. They hope sales and earnings grow. They hope the stock goes up. In active investing, an activist, we identify companies that are struggling and for a host of reasons aren't doing well. Their sales aren't growing. Their earnings aren't increasing. Their stock price is usually down. And we invest and then we offer them help. We say, look, we want to help you improve. Now, it's more complicated than that because public companies are owned by thousands of people, right? Big institutions, mom and pops. You probably own some stocks. Your dad owns stocks. And all those shareholders are represented by what we call the board of directors. So every company's got a CEO, and then on top of the CEO is the board of directors who represent the shareholder. And they say, how do we make sure we're representing our shareholder and how do we create more value? The board actually controls the company. I mean, most people see the CEO is running the business. The CEO certainly runs the business day to day, but the board oversees the direction, the agenda, the strategy, oversees a lot and makes a significant contribution. So the way we effectuate change at companies is by getting representation in the boardroom. So we think there's a company that's failing. We say, hey, let us put our people in the boardroom. Let us put people that we think are really experienced and have great skills and great expertise to help you fix these problems. And then we can work with management. Sometimes we change management. Sometimes we just coach them better and give them better resources and they perform better. And then sometimes, you know, people aren't always right for the right jobs and we make changes. That sounds great in principle. What becomes tricky is a lot of those people don't want to give up their board seat. So now yeah. You're sitting on a company's board, and often is the case, we identify companies that have really long tenured directors, meaning they've sat there for years. In Kohl's, one director's been on the board for 34 years, one director's been on the board for 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
And even though the stock hasn't performed and the investors haven't made money, they don't want to give up their seat. It's a cushy job. They make a lot of money sitting on the board for not a lot of work. Mm-hmm. So that's what happens when we say we come into a contested election. So we say, hey, let's add five of our directors to your board. Of Kohl's case, it's 13. And they say, no, we don't want your help. And I say, but you need our help. And mm-hmm. So we have this rather public debate where we talk to all shareholders and say, I think the company's really struggling and this is why. We lay out what we call our case for change. And then the board says, don't believe them. We're doing great. And we have this back and forth. Mm-hmm. And then the shareholders actually vote. It's like a presidential election. The shareholders show up and they vote, and they either vote for us or they vote for the board, or they can mix and match. They vote for some of ours and some of theirs. So it's the essence of corporate governance. It's frankly, not to get on my soapbox too much, but it's one of the things that makes the capital markets, American capital markets, so powerful and robust that shareholders have the ability to change the outcome of the stocks they invest in.
Yeah.
Many countries don't have that option, or it's much more difficult than it is in America. We talk about the competitive advantages of our country. One of the things that makes us very powerful financially is that we have this, it's the stock market. It's a very robust stock market. Obviously, it's one of the greatest stock markets in the world. But we also have this mechanism where if shareholders are disgruntled and don't feel they're being well representative, they can make change. And so it's a great process. It's one of the great benefits of democracy. You can say, I don't like this. I want to change it. And we're going to put it to a vote, and we're going to let everybody have a say in how this company is governed and how it's run. So It's kind of fun. I like it a lot. It's very dynamic. You know, you really have to understand these companies at a very detailed level. You probably don't think of me as a shopper, but I spend a lot of time in stores. We go to Kohl's, we take pictures, we take videos. And, you know, again, you're trying to convince these shareholders. Some have been to stores. Some may have never been inside of Kohl's and just thought it was a good stock and they bought it. They'd see the commercials or something. So we have to really show them like, hey, this is why we think the company isn't being well run. The numbers are easy, right? Sales went down, earnings went down, stock went down. Like, that's easy. Showing them why the store is broken or why we think the store is broken, you know, it's hard, right? You got to show them with pictures and videos. So that's where we are in the Kohl's campaign right now.
Could you give a little rundown on what's happening between McCallum Capital Management and Kohl's?
They haven't grown their sales for 10 years. Mm-hmm. Their stock price has been the same for 20 years.
Yeah.
Right? The stock market is up 3, 4, 5-fold in 20 years. Their stock is flat, $50 for 20 years. And a lot of management turnover. And again, this board, you know, we use this term entrenched. This board is very entrenched. The guys that have been on the board for a really long time kind of think it's their company, don't really feel beholden to the shareholders, and are very resistant to change. We've identified this as something that could be turned around, could be a great company. It's been a stable company, which is, you know, at least it didn't go bankrupt, I guess, but it's been stable, but it should be growing. You know, if you look at retail, whether it's Target or Walmart, Best Buy, there's so many examples, Restoration Hardware, Five Below, places you've probably heard of, so many great retailers. They should be able to grow and do so much better. And so we've identified this, we've made our investment. We own about 5% of the company. And we've nominated directors. We've done this process. We said, we think you need more help.
Yeah.
We have great directors, and we think adding our directors to your board would be a material improvement to the board and the company. And no surprise, they've said, we don't want your help because they think everything's great. And of course, if you've underperformed for 10 years and 20 years, introspectively, you'd say that they're not terribly attuned to what's going on, right? At some point, you'd have to look in the mirror and say, my God, we haven't done a good job. Maybe they're right. But these guys say, no, we got it covered. We got it covered. So, you know, we're in the middle of this, what we call a contested election. So we've nominated directors, we've shared with the whole world and our investors who our directors are and why we think there's value. As I said, we're going to give this rather substantial presentation to the investment community and give them our perspective. Now, what's really interesting about Kohl's and complicating all this is other companies are trying to buy it. So right now it's a public company, and there's a bunch of private equity companies and other retailers who say, wow, we see value in Kohl's too. And they want to buy the whole thing and take it out of the public markets, right? There's public markets where their stocks trade and they're owned by thousands of people. And then there's private markets where Apollo, KKR, Blackstone, they own all of a company, 100% of the company. And you can't buy it like we buy stocks in the stock market, right? That's private equity. So all these companies want to take it private and they're willing to pay a premium for it. So there's a really interesting dynamic where the business might be sold to one of these private equity players or one of these other retailers that's interested. If it's not sold, then we'll go to this vote and we may get control. We may not get control. Obviously, I think we've made a very powerful case for change. And our job is to convince other people we've made a powerful case, not just for change, but what to change and how to change. And then it'll go to a vote.
Why do you think Kohl's, out of all the companies, is one that has so much potential?
So this is more a process question. You know, generally, we look for companies that have self-inflicted problems. So we think Kohl's has made mistakes that they created, not that other people inflicted on them. How they run their stores, how they buy their merchandise, what the assortment looks like. So that's the first thing. And then it's got to be kind of cheap enough, right? Sometimes companies have failed, but the stocks haven't really come down and the valuation hasn't gotten cheap. So it's cheap enough. Then we want a really strong balance sheet, right? So what I said, you could have said about JCPenney or Sears, but they all went bankrupt, right? Because they had too much debt. So we want a strong balance sheet.
Kohl's has said they want to open 100 new small stores in the next 4 years, and they want to open 850 more Sephora stores. And then for their new long-term forecast, they say they forecast 7-8% in operating margin. Do you think those changes are enough, or do you think they could be doing more to potentially increase their value?
Honestly, that's kind of the crux of our pitch to the rest of the investors. Like, they're not doing nearly enough. So interesting fact, the day they presented their three-year plan, they presented at an analyst day on March 7th. The investors were so disappointed that the stock sold off 13% the day they presented that plan. So it was a real indictment of their plan. Like, they said, oh, look at all this great stuff we're doing. And people said, and they threw up all over it. And, you know, for a stock to be down 13% in a day is a lot, right? That's a really disappointing outcome. So I would say a couple things. The margin targets, you know, they're a little disingenuous. So let's see if I can get these numbers straight in my head. In 2021, they earned, let's call it operating income, $1.6 billion. They guided that down from $1.6 billion to $1.4 billion for 22. When they talk about their three-year plan, they start it at 22 and grow it back to $1.6 billion, just to where they were last year. So they're trying to tell you, you know, how great everything is. And you're like, wait a second, like, after all this, you're going to just get back to where you were in 21?
Yeah.
Like, what? Why would I ever own this stock? How are you ever going to create value for me? Yeah, the other stuff, the Sephora is fine. You know, we like Sephora. It's a good concept. I think they're spending too much money to build out the Sephora shop in the store, but it'll drive traffic. I think that'll be okay. And the 100, I mean, Kohl's has got 1,200 locations, 100 small format stores. It's fine. It's not going to move the needle. But the real problem is that they're not growing their income. We characterized it, I don't know if you saw in one of our letters, we characterize it as a high risk strategy. They're taking up their SG&A, their expenses. They're taking up their capital expenditures. So, you know, there's expenses your business has every year. And then there's CapEx, which is like a one-time spend. They're taking those two things up substantially, and they're building up their inventory levels, right? Which is, on one level, like, you have to have inventory to sell product, right? You've got to buy stuff to sell stuff. But if you buy too much of it, it gets bad really quickly. You have too much of it and you have to mark it down to sell it. So it's a very risky strategy, and they're hoping that sales grow. And you might remember I pointed out earlier that they haven't grown sales in 10 years. So, you know, all of a sudden they think their sales are going to start growing and they haven't done anything different. We're a little bit worried actually about the plan, and as were the rest of the investors who promptly sold the stock when they gave the three-year plan.
Do you have any resources like books or podcasts that we can use to learn more?
I think that's a really great question, Will. When I interview people, I often, you know, everybody says, oh, I want to come to Wall Street. Oh, I want to work on Wall Street, blah, blah, blah. And I say, really? Like, tell me the books that got you excited about coming to Wall Street. And I can't tell you how many, you know, young, aspiring kids haven't read any of the books that I would call kind of required reading if you really thought you were interested in coming to Wall Street. So, and what's great about it is so many of these books read like fiction. I mean, Den of Thieves, Liar's Poker, The Big Short. I mean, there's just so many incredible books about the rise and fall of people, about some of the corruption, some of the success stories. They're all fascinating tales that you learn a lot about people and human nature, and you also learn a lot about the business. There are a few, you know, classic, more academic books, but I think, you know, also read like fiction. Two of my favorites are Greater Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds and Devil Take the Hindmost. If I had heard this advice when I was your age and I read those two books, I would have been much more successful. They're two of the most formative books I've ever read about not just the markets, but people and human behavior. And the title suggests the madness of crowds, right? What's going on in the stock market and oftentimes are crowds, crowd thinking and how crowds act and why do they pay an infinite multiple for Amazon or Facebook, Meta, whatever we call it these days, you know, but they won't pay two times for Kohl's, right? It's how the crowd thinking, and they're fascinating books that go through history and they go to the tulip crisis. And they go to the Mississippi companies and the South Pacific companies, and they take you through the whole history of markets. I mean, they're really fantastic, fantastic books. And like I said, they read like fiction. They're fascinating. I'm trying to get my kids to read them.
I know which two books I'm reading next, that's for sure.
You should. And Remnants of a Stock Operator is an old school one. I think it's pretty short too. Remnants of a Stock Operator. That's a classic.
Do you have any parting advice?
You know, not to sound too sappy and corny, like, you know, enjoy the journey, you know, and have fun. And work can be great. It can be fun. So many of my friends I've met through work and so much of my social life revolves around work and people I've met at work are going out, work stuff and work travel. So I think you kind of throw yourself into your roles and hopefully it's something you're passionate about and enjoy. But, you know, make sure you're having fun while you're doing it because the years fly by. You know, it's hard to think about being 54 and having a daughter that's going off to college. I don't know where the years went, but luckily I was enjoying them all along and I don't have any regrets. So, you know, make sure you strike that right balance.
Well, John, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for taking the time.
No, it's really a pleasure. Well,
as always, thank you for listening and please make sure you subscribe to get updated when new podcasts come out. I'm Will Burkhart and you've been listening to Studying Success. We'll